changes in the temple ceremony focus our attention on the fact that our religion is not static, as we sometimes perceive, but ever-changing. This may seem to be somewhat of an overstatement, since the church is notoriously conservative and resistant to change, in spite of our doctrine of continuing revelation. Many of us have felt that all pleas for innovation fall on deaf ears, and yet changes do come. This should not be surprising to us, for change is inevitable in any organism that is alive or institution that is vital. Only dead people, dead languages, and dead cultures do not change, although I guess even our perceptions of them change, so maybe there's change there too. As Jewish scholar Jacob Katz observes, there is no society that does not change. However, traditional religious societies like to think of themselves as static even in the midst of change, since they see themselves as acting in accordance with the customs of the past. Katz says that the difference between a traditional society and a modern society is not change, which is a given, but that modern society aspires to change while traditional society does not. Perhaps this explains in part the church's reluctance to discuss changes even when they do come. Leaders don't like to see themselves as departing from the traditions of the fathers or changing the policies of their predecessors. If decisions of past leaders were not absolute, then doesn't that mean that the stand of present leaders can also be questioned and modified? Thus, it may be easier to hide the past than to explain how radical the changes in the church have been over the years. This creates a very real tension, a tension which is implicit not only in dealing with our history, but our doctrine as well. The scriptures talk about the unchanging nature of God and the gospel, and at the same time, one of our articles of faith states our belief in ongoing revelation. Some may dismiss differences between past and present doctrine as minimally important, based on the assumption that policy is more important than doctrine, and that times change and therefore practices have to change to meet new circumstances. And they may even argue that it's really only the practices that are changing. But this answer does not deal with the nature of the relationship between the eternal principles of the gospel and the changing circumstances of society. Although the phrase "new and everlasting covenant" does seem to hint at this paradox. And in fact, it seems like that phrase may have something of a relative and an absolute component to morality and to principles and so forth, and maybe there's a paradox there. If we fail to address this issue, we create confusion and are in danger of promoting harm as well as good with our changes. For example, there continues to be prejudice against blacks of African descent in spite of the revelation allowing them to receive the priesthood and participate in temple blessings. As Gene England explains in his recent Sunstone article, "Are All Alike Unto God?", there are still those who feel that blacks were denied the priesthood because they were less valiant in the pre-existence. Because the 1978 revelation was only a policy change and never explained why blacks were previously denied priesthood rights and why the change was being made at that time, the idea has persisted that blacks were not worthy until that time. This points out the necessity of dealing with a theology behind a practice. Parenthetically, I would like to add that I think the policy of withholding the blacks was always theologically wrong and resulted from a misunderstanding of the scope and meaning of Christ's sacrifice. When he rent the veil at his death, Christ opened the way for all to enter the temple as priests and priestesses, regardless of race, gender, or lineage. The Pearl of Great Price passages prohibiting the descendants of Ham from holding the priesthood are part of a pre-Christian context and never should have been applied in this dispensation, in my opinion. While I welcomed the 1978 revelation, even with its absence of theological explanation, I do not believe that all change is positive. Modern society, by definition, has been skeptical about the values of the past and has usually connected change with progress. But the tyranny of the present is as real a threat as the tyranny of the past. A complete allegiance to either viewpoint can make a person a prisoner of a single narrow worldview. Believing that our postmodern era has reached the pinnacle of enlightenment is just as foolish as believing in the romance of the past. Somehow we must try to balance the old and the new, always examining our motives and the principles behind holding on to tradition or promoting change. We have to ask not only what we may gain by one or the other, but also what we may lose. I, for one, feel that we may have lost as much as we gained with the recent alterations in the temple ceremony. I welcome some of the changes, dislike some, and have mixed emotions about others. For example, I know that many people objected to the penalties as part of a form of primitive violence. But I found positive as well as negative symbolism in these signs. I dislike the 19th century idea of blood atonement not only for its cruelty and stern justice, but also for its misunderstanding of the purpose of the atonement. On the other hand, if the penalties were seen as the punishment affixed for sin, which was assumed by Jesus Christ through his voluntary death, then the meaning is quite different. Anciently, the sacrificial animals were sometimes slit in the throat, breast, and bowels. Christ, as a substitute offering, also received wounds in his own body. Our life comes through his death. This is a common pattern in our world. With the very food we eat, whether plant or animal, our lives continue at the expense of some other life. This pattern becomes intolerable if those at the top of the food chain are not willing to lay down their lives to give life to those at the bottom. By eliminating the penalties, rather than restating them in a Christian context, I fear we may be making a typical 20th century mistake of failing to see the interconnectedness of life and death and the negative and the positive. We think that we can have one without the other. But nothing good comes without sacrifice, and light always casts a shadow. Refusing to admit the inevitable dark side and removing ourselves from the reality of death may even promote a carelessness about life. And not wanting to acknowledge the violence of the cross may be a form of ingratitude to the one who gave his life for us. Also, we must ask whether we can be sure that what we perceive as negative is really all bad. The temple ceremony itself talks about the necessity of opposites. We can't know pleasure without pain or health without sickness. Our transgressions show us the nature of both good and evil. Our weaknesses and strengths are always intertwined, like two sides of a coin, so that we have to be careful that in eliminating what we think is bad, we don't get rid of the good as well. For example, passion has a positive and negative side. A common mistake is to think that perfection consists in getting rid of it altogether, and what results is a sterile, superficial goodness rather than a life-giving wholeness. The problem is that most pairs of opposites are not simply the negative and positive sides of a single idea, but rather both contain positive and negative aspects. Even with symbols like light and darkness, which have traditionally been used to represent good and evil, the issue is really more complex. Anyone who has lived in a desert knows that too much light and sunshine can be destructive, and that the coolness of the dark night is a refreshing blessing. And of course, linking darkness with evil has been damaging to all those with dark skins. Moreover, the campaign that black is beautiful is an illustration of how even the long-standing use of symbols can be reversed. Ideas that are not paradoxical in this way tend to be sentimental, incomplete, and dogmatic. According to Scott Peck, the author of The Road Less Traveled and other books, if a concept is paradoxical, that itself should suggest that it smacks of integrity. that it gives off the ring of truth. Conversely, if a concept is not in the least paradoxical, you should be suspicious of it and suspect that it has failed to integrate some aspect of the whole. The same may be said of symbols. Because symbolism expresses complex truths about the nature of reality, the most universal and ancient symbols seem always to encompass simultaneously a variety of conflicting ideas. An example of such a multifaceted symbol pertinent to the temple creation story is the serpent, which can represent either death or resurrection, Satan or Christ. In the Genesis account, the serpent is connected with the devil. But elsewhere, Moses raises up a pole with a serpent image as a representation of the Savior God who heals and gives life. The serpent may also represent either a male god or a female goddess. When it is in an upright position, it represents the phallus. When it is coiled in a circle, it represents the womb. It can be associated with the earth, the sun, the moon, with water, or when it is winged, with the air. Since the world itself is comprised of opposites, its yin-yang quality reflected in Lehi's notion that all things are a compound in one, effective and enduring symbols express and illuminate this dualistic aspect of reality. J.C. Cooper put it this way: much of symbolism directly concerns the dramatic interplay and interaction of the opposing forces in the dualistic world of manifestation. Their conflicting but also complementary and compensating characteristics and their final union. Because this is so, it seems a mistake to eliminate symbols because they have a negative side. Often reinterpretation and recontextualization may be better techniques than complete elimination. The Mormon temple ceremony is set forth in symbolic language. It contains many levels of meaning simultaneously and therefore is conducive to constant reinterpretation. The process of reinterpretation does not consist merely in the rejection of the old meanings. It also involves the reevaluation of the symbols in terms of new light and knowledge. This process requires a constant balancing addition and progress of the old and the new. In the rest of this paper, I would like to show ways in which a temple symbol can be reinterpreted rather than removed to meet the concerns of our time. The face veil, worn as a headdress by women throughout the Mormon temple rites and used to cover the faces of women during a ritual prayer, is an image that has been disturbing to many women. When taken together with covenants of obedience that women make to men, it seems to be a symbol of female subordination to males. Although the covenant of obedience has been softened with other recent changes, the veil symbol remains. I will argue here that it would be a mistake to eliminate the veil symbol because of all the positive meanings connected with it. Rather, I think we should reinvest it with other associations. We should note that simply changing the covenant of obedience has already put the face veil in a new context. Unfortunately, the covenant was not modified enough, in my opinion. If both the man and woman covenanted to obey God and hearken to the voice of the other, there would be reciprocity and an acknowledgement of mutual interdependence. As with all profound symbols, the veil is a paradoxical symbol that evokes both positive and negative images. However, for our modern age, the negative side dominates. There are two major sources for this negative view. The first of these is the Islamic custom that requires women to veil not only their faces, but literally their whole bodies. In this culture, women are subordinated to men in every possible way. It should be noted, however, out of respect for this religious tradition, that these extreme customs are the product of Islamic fundamentalism and are not observed by all those who adhere to the Muslim faith. Many devout Islamic women do not wear the face veil at all, but simply a covering on their heads. They would argue that men are also required to cover their heads, and that both forms of head covering are signs of honor. Though the veiled Muslim woman is a strong image for moderns of the subordination and oppression of women, it is unlikely that Joseph was influenced by this source when he introduced the veil for women in the temple. Therefore, it seems historically unwarranted to apply this Muslim connotation of the veil to the temple headdress for women. Nonetheless, many may be hard-pressed to quell a strong psychological and even religious aversion to this symbol. A more likely source for Joseph Smith's use of the veil is the biblical passage in 1 Corinthians 11, 13-15, where Paul argued ought to pray with her head covered, since she is the glory of man, whereas the man ought to pray with his head uncovered, since he is the glory of God. Historically, this scripture has been a mainstay of arguments claiming divine sanction for women's subordination to men, especially in the Catholic tradition. For example, in a 1968 biblical commentary on this verse, several noted scholars conclude that God has ordained both a natural and a religious hierarchy in which the subordination of the woman should be recognized in her behavior and dress. The veil is a symbol of this subordination. Other scholars, however, have noted problems with this interpretation. While admitting that Paul does subordinate women to men, they have pointed out that he almost seems to give back with one hand what he takes with the other. Whereas Paul says first that the man is not of the woman, but the woman of the man, he turns right around and makes the following equalizing statement. Nevertheless, neither is the man without the woman, neither the woman without the man in the Lord. For the woman is of the man, even so is the man also by the woman, but all things of God. Moreover, the passage in 1 Corinthians 11 centers on a discussion of how women should be attired when they pray or prophesy, implying that women are praying and prophesying in public meetings, something which was not done in the Jewish synagogues. This evidences that Christians were granting women greater status than they had been allowed previously. The congruence of evidence, both of equality and subordination of women in this passage, has led some to conclude that while the apostle accepted the traditional social view of the status of women, he rejected the traditional religious view, for Paul saw that all were made free in Jesus Christ. Paul's argument in Corinthians 11, then, would be an appeal to abide by the dress customs of his day so as not to disturb more than necessary those who were offended by Christianity's new and more favorable treatment of women. This argument coincides with Paul's advice in 1 Corinthians 10, where he admonishes the Corinthian saints to refrain from eating meat sacrificed to idols to avoid offending weaker saints or possible converts. For these same reasons, Paul may be recommending decorum in dress to women who are praying and prophesying. History provides another piece to the puzzle. Though the married women of Paul's time did wear veils or coverings over their hair, this was not always true throughout the Old Testament period. Sometimes women wore head coverings, and at other times they did not. And this was also true for men. And of course, in most modern Jewish worship, it is the men who are required to cover their heads, though strict Orthodox women cover their hair all the time. These kinds of changes in custom have reinforced the idea for some that Paul was not attempting to state a universal truth in 1 Corinthians 11, but was addressing a specific problem in view of prevailing customs. Some Latter-day Saints may wonder if in 1 Corinthians 11, Paul may be alluding to an early Christian endowment-like ritual, records of which are lost to us. But there are problems with this view. If Joseph Smith was relying on this passage as authority for the use of the face veil for women in temple worship, he didn't follow it very closely. Paul says that it is a dishonor to God for a man to cover his head while praying, and yet in the Mormon endowment and prayer circle, the man's head is covered the whole time. Also, nowhere in the Corinthians passage Does Paul talk about a woman veiling her face? He only talks of her covering her head. If Corinthians is not Joseph Smith's source for the face veil, what is? There is no reliable and conclusive evidence to answer this question. Sources as divergent as magical practices, scriptural traditions, or obscure folk customs may have influenced Joseph Smith. And of course, God may have revealed the use of the face veil with no secular or sacred precedent. However, identifying Joseph Smith's sources of the face veil, though useful and important, is not what this paper is about. My purpose here is to explore the possible meanings which this symbol may have for Mormons. One way to further this exploration is to examine our scriptural texts for indications of the use of the veil in ancient biblical cultures. There are only a few scriptural examples of a person with a veil-covered face, and each example shows a different way in which the veil can function symbolically. Tamar, the daughter-in-law of Judah, covered herself with a shawl or veil and concealed her face in order to trick Judah into thinking that she was a prostitute. However, another reference indicates that it must not have been chiefly the veil which signified prostitution, but the setting in which Tamar put herself, since the same word used here for veil is also used in Genesis 24:65 without any suggestion of prostitution. In the second case, Rebekah covered herself with a veil when she first met Isaac. Her veil apparently served a bridal function, whereas in Tamar's case, its function was to conceal her identity. The woman in the Song of Solomon also wore a face veil, but the word for veil in this verse is translated from a different Hebrew word which can suggest a bridal purpose, but is more simply ornamental and erotic. In the Bible, men are also sometimes depicted as veiling their faces. For example, King David covered his face when he mourned for his dead son Absalom. It is unclear in this passage what David used to cover his face. It could have been his hands or a shawl or a cloak. The meaning of the gesture, though, seems to have been connected with mourning. At another time, David wept and veiled his head, as did the people who were with him. This was a sign of his grief at being forced to leave Jerusalem. The prophet Ezekiel was commanded to cover his face so he would not see the land as he left Jerusalem, possibly to symbolize the spiritual blindness of his people who would soon be forced to leave the city. Perhaps the most illuminating account of a veil-covered face in the scriptures is found in Exodus 34:33-35, where Moses veiled his face when he came down from the mountain from the presence of God. Because Moses was so full of the glory or light of God, the people could not look directly upon his countenance. When Moses went back to talk to God, he removed the veil again. In this story, God is also depicted as being veiled. Only the divine veil is a cloud which covers God's glory. Exodus 34:4 states, "And the Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him, Moses, there, and proclaimed the name of the Lord." This last account of a veil image accords with the myths of other ancient cultures, where deities were often portrayed as hiding their dazzling brightness behind a mask or veil, both to protect humans from injury because of their glory and also to see without being seen. In some of these cultures, veils were especially associated with earth and fertility goddesses. For example, in one complex section of the Hymn to Demeter, the Greek goddess Demeter is depicted as being veiled while seated on a sheepskin. The symbols of the veil and the sheepskin are believed to have had ritual significance in the Eleusinian mystery cult, in which the demigod Heracles figured prominently. A bas-relief on a vase depicting the veiled Heracles sitting on a ram skin corroborates the significance of the ritual use of the veil. For it is well attested in myth and art that Heracles was initiated into the Eleusinian mysteries to prepare him for his descent into the underworld as part of a heroic quest. In this ritual context, the veil, which is thrown over the head of the initiate, like the amniotic sac or cocoon, serves as a symbol of rebirth. A similar ritual usage of the veil is found in the Gilgamesh epic. Gilgamesh, a hero like Heracles, while engaged on a heroic quest to find the plant of life, encounters Siduri, a goddess of wisdom and a patroness of wine merchants. Gilgamesh, clad in a skin garment, approaches the veiled goddess to ask her how he may find his way to a boatman to ferry him across some great waters. Here again, the veil and the skins are associated with the hero's rite of passage. Another example is found in the Odyssey, where the shipwrecked Odysseus is swimming naked in a treacherous sea in a desperate attempt to reach shore. The goddess Leucothoe comes to his rescue and gives him her veil to tie around his waist, thus empowering him to reach land safely. This entire scene is replete with rebirth imagery, suggesting that Odysseus has ritually passed into a new phase of life. In this instance, the veil tied around the hero's waist represents an umbilicus, connecting him with the divine powers that are protecting him. In these examples, the veil is connected not with the inferiority of women, but with the goddess as the keeper of the gate or mystery, which the initiate, often a man, but sometimes a woman, either naked or skin-clad, must penetrate in order to obtain knowledge of a new or unseen world. The veil is also symbolically connected with the hymen, and as such, represents the covering over the holy place, the inner sanctuary of the temple, which was anciently thought of as the body of the goddess, into which the god or hero or priest-king had to enter to obtain the hidden wisdom or power. In some myths, the acquisition by the hero of what is hidden or unobtainable can be accomplished only by his becoming invisible, by means of a cap or a veil. In the story of Perseus and Medusa, Perseus is given a magic cap by the gods in order to render him invisible and therefore give him power over the monster Medusa. Thus, caps and veils can function as keys of access to the spiritual world by enabling their wearers to enter dangerous, sacred, or forbidden places without being noticed or harmed. The veil, then, also emerges as a symbol of invisibility, mystery, and hidden power. And here, too, is another instance of how a symbol can function in both positive and negative ways. Invisibility, as we have seen, can bring great power and knowledge, but it can also prevent a person from being known or having any direct influence. The good and bad aspects of being veiled or invisible are reflected in the word reveal, which is connected to veil, which can have opposing meanings. Both derive from its Latin stem. It can mean to unveil or to veil again. Thus, the veil, like symbols in general, can either reveal or conceal what is hidden. In the worship of both the Greek goddess Athena and the Egyptian goddess Isis, the veil appears not as a covering for the face, but in the form of a curtain to separate these divinities from their worshippers. At a certain point in their rituals, the curtain was pulled back so that these goddesses' images could be revealed. In Sais, the goddess Athena, whom they believed to be Isis, bore this inscription, "I am all that has been and is and shall be, and my veil no mortal has yet uncovered." In some mythologies, the veil, when it appeared in the form of a curtain, was symbolic of the universe which the goddess weaves, or in other words, the world of manifestation woven by the great goddess. It is significant that Athena, the Greek goddess of wisdom, was also the goddess of weaving. Her robe or peplos, embroidered with mythological symbols, was carried like the sail of a galley in public processions at the time of her festival. In the Christian apocryphal book of James, the Virgin Mary is chosen by the priests of the temple to weave the temple veil from thread of blue, scarlet, and purple. It is while she is spinning the thread that the angel appears to tell her that she will bear the Son of God. But whether manifest as a curtain or as a face covering or even as a girdle, the veil represents the boundary between the sacred and the profane. In myth and ritual, the veil signifies the threshold that must be passed to gain life or esoteric knowledge. Sometimes the initiate wears the veil, as does Heracles and Odysseus, and sometimes it is worn by the deity, as in the case of Demeter or Siduri. Anciently, the wearers of masks or veils were identified as gods or goddesses, at least for the participation in the sacred drama or procession. The image of a god or goddess behind a veil or embroidered curtain brings us back to the more familiar symbols of the Israelite and Mormon temple veils. The Israelites' ancient tabernacle and later their temple contained several sets of veils, which covered the entrances to the various sanctuaries within them. In fact, the walls of the tabernacle built by Moses consisted of curtains or veils, and a special embroidered veil was used to hide the Holy of Holies. In the Mormon temple, what is called the veil of the temple actually consists of a number of identically embroidered veils, usually set side by side. Within the context of the endowment, the temple veil is symbolically connected with the embroidered priesthood undergarment. Both the veil and the garment contain similar ritual markings, suggesting that our physical bodies constitute the veil or boundary that separates us from the spiritual realm. This connection between the veil and the body is supported by the New Testament writer of the Epistle to the Hebrews, who connects the veil of the temple with the flesh of Christ. This writer explains that under Jewish law, only the high priest could enter the Holy of Holies in order to make a blood offering for the people. He then goes on to say that this ritual foreshadowed the sacrifice of Christ. According to this writer, Jesus is our great high priest. Because he was sacrificed on the altar of the world and passed beyond the veil of his mortal flesh into the true Holy of Holies of heaven, he has opened the way to God for all of us. To this end, the epistle states, "Having therefore, brethren and sisters, boldness to enter into the holiest by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way, which he hath consecrated for us through the veil, that is to say, his flesh." This verse also seems to refer to the tradition set forth in the Gospels that at the time of Christ's death, the veil in the temple at Jerusalem was rent in two, symbolizing the teaching that Christ parted the veil of mortality so that all could freely enter into eternal life and the presence of the Most High. It is interesting that the identification of Christ's body with a veil also emerges in the legends of the Shroud of Turin, on which is imprinted the image of Christ's mortal body, and in the story of how Christ's countenance was impressed in blood on Veronica's veil, which according to tradition, she used to wipe the face of Jesus as he ascended the hill of Calvary. An associated usage of the veil in Christian ritual is manifest in the custom of veiling the cross during the Easter season to commemorate the 3 days when Christ's body was in the tomb. This Christian custom finds a parallel in Babylonian New Year rites, in which the shrine of Nabu was veiled in memory of his descent into the underworld. Keeping all of these associations in mind, how can we interpret the image of the veiled woman in the Mormon temple? First, we should note that in none of the sources we have examined has the veil been used strictly as a symbol of female inferiority. In all of these contexts, the veil is expressive of a number of complex and even conflicting meanings. The most important of these meanings is associated with the rite of passage, which involves the concept of rebirth. In the Mormon temple ceremony, rebirth is a predominant theme. The initiates are first washed and cleansed as if from the blood of birth, are clad in coats of skin, represented by the white priesthood undergarments, and then, like newborns, they are given new names. Thus, they are brought out of the world of the profane into the world of the sacred and are sent on a spiritual quest like heroes and heroines. They are told that their models in this pilgrimage are their spiritual progenitors, Adam and Eve. The purpose of their search is to obtain the mysteries of godliness and to eat of the fruit of the tree of life. To do this, they must receive instruction from angels, pass certain tests, and finally approach the veil where they will receive final empowerment from God. On this spiritual journey, the initiates are given piece by piece sacred clothing which symbolizes the bestowal upon them of grace, power, and spirit, knowledge, and authority, in other words, the priesthood of God, that allows them to bring their quest to fruition. It is important to note in this regard that from the undergarment to the outer robes, the only ritually significant difference between the temple clothing of men and women is the head covering. The men wear caps and the women wear veils. This difference, in my view, does not mean that women are inferior, but it may mean that the priesthood as vested in women has some manifestations and functions that distinguish it from those associated with the priesthood as vested in men. In other words, the different head coverings signify that the priesthood has a female as well as a male modality. However, it must be remembered that the differences in the priesthood robes of men and women, and by implication the priesthood functions of men and women, are few when compared to their similarities. Although the cap and the veil may symbolize subtle differences in priesthood, they also accomplish the same ritual function within the context of the endowment, because they signify the crowns of glory placed upon the initiates as symbolic of their anticipated status as kings and queens and priests and priestesses. But why is it the woman instead of the man who must wear the veil in the temple? One reason is that in the scriptures, the woman is used as a symbol for Israel, for the Christian church, for the world, and for the earth, each of which is separated from God by a veil. As a symbol of God's people, the woman is also called the wife of God or the bride of Christ, which brings to mind the image of the bridal veil. In fact, the Gnostic Gospel of Philip calls the Holy of Holies the bridal chamber, which is entered by going through a veil. But the bride of God is not merely the earthly church, she is also a heavenly goddess. For this reason, the woman in the temple ceremony represents what is on both sides of the veil: the visible world, including all the people of the earth who are covered by it, and the invisible world, including the realm of hidden divinities and hidden power, which lies beyond the veil. Now, men too function as symbols in the temple. They also represent both humanity and divinity. Although it is true that in ritual, one person can play many roles, our culture has assigned symbolic roles to males and females that more often link men with divinity and women with humanity. The recurrent use in our culture of the female as a symbol of the lower or material world and of the male as the representation of the higher or spiritual world has reinforced the notion that women are inferior. This has happened in large part because our Western religious tradition has been virtually stripped of all the imagery of a female divinity. The heavenly mother or goddess is missing. This is true in Mormonism as well as other Christian religions. The point is that in the temple, it is difficult to see how the woman also reflects the image of the divine. That is why I must stress here that in the temple, the veiled woman represents the goddess, the heavenly bride, who is hidden and who must yet be revealed. What the temple has been teaching us for years symbolically is that what many feminists have been recently saying, it is the woman's identity and power that must yet be unveiled in this dispensation. But why does the woman veil her face in the prayer circle? To answer this question, we must recall that the temple prayer ritual, like all prayer, is the means by which a person encounters God. In other words, in prayer, an individual approaches the veil to knock, ask, and seek what is hidden. In the prayer circle, the veiled woman represents Israel, the church, the world, the earth, Eve, as well as the whole group of men and women in the prayer circle, each of whom is separated from God by the veil, but each of whom is invited to pursue the spiritual journey to the veil where the mysteries of God will be revealed. At the same time, the woman represents the hidden divinity behind the veil who, when the prayer is over, will unveil her face so that all may look directly upon the divine glory. But isn't it demeaning for women to wear the veil, since it implies that they cannot view God directly while men can? The view that the veil is demeaning does not actually hold up scripturally or symbolically. No man or woman can see God and live unless they have been transformed by the Spirit. Moreover, when men and women actually approach and pass through the Mormon temple veil, they enter with their faces exposed. If the face veil meant that women could not view God directly, then they would be veiled at the point of entrance into the celestial presence. Furthermore, as we have seen in our examination of veil imagery, what is veiled or hidden is usually not inferior but superior to what is unveiled. It's the divine presence, the sacred place, the Holy of Holies, the celestial world. It is true that the scriptures talk about a veil of darkness or unbelief which covers the people. Here is the other side of the symbol. But we must remember that this veil covers all people, not just women. And two, the veil of darkness has its positive meaning. It is a symbol of protection. It is the cloak of Christ's charity or mercy that protects us in this probationary state from the brightness of God's glory, which would destroy us until we can be transformed to endure God's presence. Thus, the veil of Christ's charity covers a multitude of sins. In his mythic novel, Till We Have Faces, C.S. Lewis uses the veil image in a similar way. The veil hides our sin, our ugliness, our facelessness, of all people, not just women. We cannot unveil the face of God until we first have faces to see. Then we will see as we are seen. We should also note that both men and women embrace God through the veil before entering the celestial room. This symbolizes that our contact with God is made possible through Jesus Christ, whose body, as we have seen, is represented by the veil. The marks in the veil represent his wounds, suggesting that our way to God is through Christ's sacrifice. Before God accepts us into his presence, or her presence, he feels to see if we have received the wounds of Christ in our bodies. It is because we have been ritually received the imputation of Christ's crucifixion that we are empowered to enter the most sacred place. Thus, the veil, the caps, the embroidered garments, the veil of the temple itself are symbols not of inferiority but of rebirth and initiation, which is made possible through the atoning blood of Christ. And this is another way in which we have patterns of change in the temple, that the purpose of the ritual is to bring about the rebirth or the change. By his sacrificial act, Christ the bridegroom rent the veil, parted it, and opened the way into the most sacred place for all, both male and female alike, for in Jesus Christ are all made free. But who has dared to enter freely into the holy place or to look upon the very quality of the heavens? It has been easier for us, I fear, to retreat into the comfortable confines of our darkness than to open ourselves to new possibilities. It is more respectable to keep our symbols secret than to understand what they mean. For my part, I believe that the purpose of the temple is to enlighten and empower us to part the veil and see as we are seen and know as we are known. Though we cannot part the veil for ourselves, we can stand at the door and knock with receptive hearts, waiting for God to open. But as the Apostle Paul observed, unbelief keeps many from seeing, for the veil is upon their heart. Nevertheless, he promises, when they shall turn to the Lord, the veil shall be taken away, for where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. But we all, with open, unveiled face, beholding as in a glass the glory of the Lord, are changed into the same image from glory to glory, even as by the Spirit of the Lord. Because we are not taught to read, reinterpret, and revitalize our religious symbols, we are in danger of losing them. I, for one, do not wish to lose the richness of any of our symbols, particularly that of the face veil. And yet neither do I wish to see it used to justify the subordination of women. I frankly doubt that my complex interpretation of the face veil will become generally accepted in the church. It is much more likely that this symbol will continue to be perceived and presented as a negative image for women and as a justification for their continued disenfranchisement. Because of the richness and vitality the symbol has for me, I will continue to wear the face veil in the temple. But because it has become a symbol of the oppression and subordination of women in our age, then symbolically, I rend my veil in two. And on the pieces, I write a new interpretation, a new paradigm, a title of liberty. For all those whose faces have been hidden and hearts broken behind a veil of spiritual alienation and oppression. And I also write in memory of our mother, the goddess, and of our Father, Jesus Christ, and of his gospel that calls us out of bondage and fear and sin to bear one another's burdens until that day when with open faces we may look upon the unveiled faces of the Most High. We have, about 12, 13 minutes left for questions. I read it slowly, so I didn't cut any out, and I read it slowly since there was no respondent. Any questions or responses? You don't have to ask a question. Yes. I agree with the question or comment was this, that when we go to the temple, we're not prepared for the symbolism. And she asked what we could do to prepare and maybe be better able to respond to the symbols. In the earlier version of this paper, I have about 6 different versions. It's like a myth. It has all these different versions. But I dealt with that a lot because I really think that that's one of the major problems, that the world that we live in is very much, our culture is very pragmatic, we're very much oriented to the everyday. We don't at all live in a sacral culture like you find among the Hopis and the Navajos, where symbolism and myth and ritual are just a part of their lifestyle. And so it's so totally foreign to us that when we go to the temple, it's jarring. You know, in spite, even not even talking about maybe all of the theological or other problems that you have, just the experience of going there is extremely jarring. I feel like that the only way that we can deal with this is to start talking. And, of course, this presents a real problem. How can we talk without, breaking the covenants that we make there? Now we can talk about symbolism in general. I think that that would help if we would just prepare people by giving them some basic tools to deal with ritual, to deal with symbol, and to show how different it is from our regular approach. So I think that maybe that would be a place to begin. I also think that we can do a lot more talking about the temple than we do. Although I take my covenants of secrecy serious, I do not see them as saying that we can't discuss any element of the temple, obviously, right? Although many, might be offended by my paper. I hope not. It's not meant to be offensive. But, the point where I say if we don't talk about it, if we don't think about it, it becomes alienating. So I think it's really talking. Sonia? I can't possibly repeat that, but it was such a wonderful comment. I've had the same experience. Paul and I were invited by a person who knew of us through a mutual friend, and he invited us. He didn't know about our bad reputation in the church, and so he invited us to talk to this group of his elders' quorum at a party. And when he called around and they said that they were going to discuss the temple, and they had the largest attendance at that elders' quorum party than they had ever had. I mean, there were people it was on the backyard, and there were people everywhere. And I felt the same thing. There was such a hunger just to talk about it. Now, a few people were slightly nervous, and he said that there were some people that didn't come because they were too nervous. But mostly, there was a hunger. And it was so exciting to us just to have that experience of exchange. And almost everyone afterwards came up and said, this was so helpful, this is so enlightening, I wish we could do it more. Can we have another fireside like this? And so I agree with you. People are hungry for it. They want to talk about it. And I just think it's real tragic that we don't. Any other? Yes.
I hope this is encouraging news. A couple of years ago, when Paul Dunn was still making the circuit in stake conferences, maybe he still is, but he came to the Mount Pleasant stake where I live, and in the Saturday night session of our conference, talked about this subject. And he encouraged parents to, and again, I think in the home is where a lot of delicate things can be talked about best. Public discussion is good, but I think at home is better. And he said, sit down with your children, show them your temple robes, talk about what they mean to you, and prepare them for going to the temple. He talked, and he cited many examples that he had run into in his life of young people going to the temple for the first time and being blown out the door of the church, literally, and running out and not coming back. and being, you know, frightfully unprepared for that. I think another thing, a comment that a friend made recently, we were talking about how to prepare your children for the temple, and he said, get them from an early age to talk about their dreams, to start dealing with the shadows, to start dealing with symbols. And then going into the scriptures with that format. Talk about Lehi's dream. Talk about this journey into the wilderness and these different things. That's my comment.
Yeah, we could prepare just simply by even approaching the scriptures symbolically. In fact, I think that, I mean, it's such a shame. I see this all the time in the church, that there's so much that remains very puzzling if you're only looking at it on a literal level. If we start thinking about things in more symbolic terms in other contexts, I agree with you. It would be really helpful. When you talked about your children, I had that experience with my children. My daughter was saying how she didn't want to get married in the temple when she grew up because she didn't want to wear garments because she wanted to wear strapless evening gowns. I said, I kind of like to wear strapless evening gowns too. But then I told her, I explained to her what I felt the marks meant and why I wear my garments, even though I would maybe rather not wear them sometimes, what they mean to me and what I think the symbols mean. And my daughters, who are still very little, you know, they're, 11 through 5, were fascinated by this. And I think it was very helpful to them just to hear that.
The problem for me, is there some way you can train yourself or study this so that you can understand it better?
The question was whether or not there's some preparation you can have for thinking in symbolic terms. I guess with me, it was, I mean, I have a BA in English, and so you think about symbols and metaphors a lot. And then I went into ancient languages and mythology. I taught mythology, and I would say that my studies in mythology and looking at symbolic motifs in mythology probably helped me in the temple more than anything else. So I don't know. I think it's by reading and reading things that take that approach. Literature, and so forth. Any other suggestions, too? Julie?
Well, I was going to say, you can be very left-brained in thinking about symbols and technical writing.
Yeah, mathematics uses numerical, actually there's a lot of numerical symbolism in the temple, too. I mean, you can deal with numbers as symbols also. Yeah, just even opening yourself up to it. I think sometimes it's that people, it's like it never occurs to them because we don't really usually use that tool. It's not something we use in our discussions in gospel doctrine class. Right? Yes?
There's also a very good smaller book by Jim Stoner called Joseph Campbell, and it's called The Power of Myth, which they also did an enormous series, and I found that.
Yeah, recently on PBS there was the series The Power of Myth by Joseph Campbell. They've rerun that on Channel 7 many times, and you can get it at libraries. And I think that that is an excellent film for someone who's never been exposed to myth and symbol. That might help you more than anything, The Power of Myth. It's in book form and also in video. You can find them both in libraries. That's a really good question. The question was, if symbols are so rich and have so many possibilities, then it seems like you can make a symbol mean anything, and therefore it's sort of meaningless. I would say the context is the important thing. Although it's interesting with the veil symbol, I looked at this for about three years, and I had a very hard time finding things on the veil. Other symbols, it seems like that they're, you find them more often. But I really think context is the clue. And in fact, the serpent symbol that I used, where it's really a universal symbol and has so many opposing meanings, I think it's very much the context. That, you know, how it's used in the story in Genesis in the garden is very different from the Moses story. And so it's by the context of where the symbol is used that you have the meaning of the symbol in that particular instance. And I think that's also true in the temple, that, you know, just the context helps. Paul? Oh, one more.
So in language, we do it all the time. It's by contextualizing.
Yeah, and symbols are a language. Symbols are a type of language. We have time for one more question. Anyone that hasn't? Okay, go ahead. Yeah, and, of course, that fits right in with modern theory, critical theories, that the reader, yeah, deconstructionism, where the reader is the one who the text now belongs to the reader, and the reader has the right to do with the text what the reader will. And in a sense, I guess I'm doing that a little bit with the veil, saying that, okay, wherever the source of the veil is, we have the right to appropriate the symbol and use it for ourselves. And so I think that's also true. Thank you very much.